Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the annual lecture in Law and Society. This lecture is sponsored jointly by the Centre for Social Legal Studies, which is a research department within the university, part of the law faculty, and dedicated to the study of law and society, as the title would suggest. It's also jointly sponsored by the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society, which is an independent institution affiliated with the University of Oxford, but dedicated particularly to making research in law and social science more widely available to the non-academic world, government, business, legal profession, and international institutions. So I want to just say a little bit about the program in which this lecture, of which this lecture forms part. It's part of a program of research and discussion being conducted jointly by those two institutions on the social and political foundations of public law. In considering the social and political foundations of public law, it seems sensible to start with constitutions and then perhaps work on to administrative law. In the workshop tomorrow, by the way, it's not too late to enroll if you feel like coming still, but at the workshop tomorrow, we shall be examining both theoretically and empirically several different constitutional traditions with a view to forming some, perhaps, generalizations about the social foundations of constitutions. Constitutions as written documents setting out the rules for the conduct of government are relatively new notions. Every country is expected to have one. There's even talk of one for the UK, the long-established bastion of an unwritten constitution, unwritten at least in the sense that there's no one document to which you can point to as the constitution, written in some ways. If every country is expected to have a written constitution, then questions arise as to how they're made, what influences their shape and content. It used to be thought that constitutions were an expression of fundamental values and beliefs of the society. But in an age where everyone is meant to have one, constitutions have become much more standardized, and that connection to deep values is no longer certain. Once adopted, how are they interpreted and applied raises another set of issues. Constitutions have to be interpreted by governments and administrative bodies and a host of other institutions. So what are the variables that influence interpretation and application? And then, of course, come the courts. We've come to think of courts as the guardians of the Constitution, as uniquely qualified to rule, ultimately, on their meanings. But what are the advantages and disadvantages of that? And how true is that of modern constitutional systems? Well, I could go on, but actually I'm not the lecturer tonight. I hope that I've said enough, however, to whet your appetite in anticipation of the lecture, which has the title Politicizing Law, Judicializing Politics, a Realistic Approach to Comparative Constitutionalism. Our lecturer, Professor Ran Herschel, is Professor of Political Science and Law at Toronto University, where he holds a research chair in constitutionalism, democracy and development. He has degrees from Tel Aviv and a doctorate from Yale. Professor Hirsch has spent time at numerous universities, particularly in the United States, and has a very impressive record of publications in the field of really the interface, the interrelationship between law and politics in a comparative perspective. I think he came to our attention, perhaps being a little insular about this, he came to our attention with his book Towards Juristocracy, The Origins and Consequences of the New Constitutionalism. I think he made that word up, by the way. I looked it up in the dictionary, it ain't there. This, I think, brought his work very much to the fore of anyone interested in those issues of the social and political foundations of constitutions. He has another book forthcoming, Constitutional Theocracy, which is a little easier to say, expected later this year and eagerly awaited. Well, I could go on, but it's a great pleasure to welcome Professor Herschel to deliver this year's annual lecture. Thank you.
Well, First of all, thank you, Dennis, for the generous introduction. And I think the foundation for the kind invitation to participate, this seems like a wonderful initiative, comparative initiative, timely, topical, and I look forward to tomorrow's conversation as well as to the next stage. Thank you all for coming. I know that this event competes with several other events at Oxford, so I appreciate your willingness to spend an hour plus with us. In many respects, I feel like, I think it was Montesquieu who once said that a French man never speaks about his wife before his friends because he is concerned that maybe his friends know more about his wife than he does. So, chauvinism aside, the analogy or the metaphor is fairly clear. I'm a French man, and comparative constitutional law is my wife, and you are my friends. But I will do my best to entertain you. These are very exciting days for scholars of comparative constitutionalism. From a relatively marginal field occupied by the devoted few, comparative constitutional law has emerged as one of the most fashionable subjects in contemporary public law scholarship. One of the main reasons for the revival is the global convergence to constitutional supremacy, a concept that has long been a major pillar of American political order and that is now shared in one form or another by over 150 countries across the globe. Most of these countries have a recently adopted constitution or a constitutional revision that contains a Bill of Rights and establishes some form of active judicial review. Consequently, there has been a tremendous growth worldwide in their reliance on courts for dealing with some of the most fundamental quandaries a democratic polity, or indeed a polity in general, can contemplate. As former Chief Justice of the Israeli Supreme Court, Aaron Barak, once said, the world is filled with law, everything is justiciable. This trend is arguably one of the most important phenomena in early 21st century government. So if you compare the situation today in terms of the judicialization of pretty much everything to only 30, 40, 50 years ago, this is a whole new universe. A vibrant international conversation among jurists and scholars, aided by new information technologies, has generated a considerable knowledge bank about the many different constitutional systems around the world. This allows us to explore with relative ease seldom traveled constitutional destinations, as I will try to do today. More importantly, thanks to this rich body of information, it is now possible, perhaps for the first time, to draw on methodologically astute comparative research to test hypotheses and to formulate generalizable insights concerning the causal relationship between law and various social and political phenomena. A serious dialogue between ideas and evidence, theory and data, has begun to complement and enrich post-World War II orthodoxy of canonical constitutional thought. Constitutions are widely perceived as power-limiting measures often associated with liberal and/or egalitarian values. Their adoption is often portrayed as a reflection of progressive social or political change or simply as a result of society's or politicians' devotion to a thick notion of democracy and their uncritical celebration of rights. Institutional economists, Douglas North would be an example, see constitutions as credible commitment instruments that in turn enhance economic performance. Functionalist, systemic, need-based explanations of the emergence of constitutional review emphasize complex coordination challenges such as the rise of the administrative state, federalism, and so on. To the extent that societal factors matter, it is often in the context of demand-side or bottom-up, rights-based calls for constitutional change. Two key elements that I want to emphasize in my lecture today that are chronically missing from these canonical explanations are supply-side political interests and design factors, writ small or large. With respect to constitutional design, a breakthrough, I think, comes with the, again, methodologically astute work of a number of scholars most recent book by my friends Zach Elkins and Tom Ginsberg and others, who attempt to explain, for example, the variance in the lifespan of national constitutions. Or why is it that some national constitutions live much longer than others? Drawing on a comprehensive, never-before-assembled data set on constitutions of the world from 1789 to 2005, this is a mere 216 years of modern constitutionalism, they provide a fair bit of news. While constitutions are written to last, they vary considerably in terms of their endurance. Some constitutions are relatively long-lived. In addition to the U.S. Constitution, Norway's constitution was adopted in 1814 and is the second oldest written constitution currently in existence. Sweden's 1809 constitution was replaced in 1974 at the age of 165 years. The 1874 constitution of Switzerland was replaced by a new one in 99 at the age of 125 years. But the life expectancy of other constitutions is quite short. Only half of all constitutions last more than 9 years, with an overall average of 19 years. Thus, the average citizen in, say, non-OECD world country should expect to see her country cycle through 3 or 4 constitutions in her lifetime. Matters of constitutional drafting and design matter a great deal. Enduring constitutions emerge by virtue of a relatively inclusive drafting stage, tend to be detailed, and more often than not are adaptable and have relative flexible amending formula and modernizing or modernization processes. An important lesson then here is that unlike nature, when it comes to constitutional design, Lamarckism may be a more powerful idea than Darwinism. Whereas Darwin's theory of evolution emphasizes the value of random mutations in overcoming exogenous shocks, with species that lack these beneficial features becoming extinct, Lamarck's theory of, inheritance of acquired characters suggests that learned experience may be incorporated into one's genes and transformed into organic features. So reflexive designs with effective built-in adjustment and auto-learning mechanisms work better than rigid designs in that respect. The closest constitutional designs get to addressing these issues is by having mechanisms such as amending formula, designated residual powers to fill newly created gaps, and living constitution or living tree interpretive approaches. As the U.S. example illustrates, however, broad, over-rigid constitutions may lead to fierce debate concerning interpretive approaches. In fact, one could argue that a main reason why the domain of religion, for example, has seen so many internal interpretive wars over the centuries is precisely because sacred texts may be easy to interpret or distort, but are impossible or near impossible to amend. The fact that that constitutional orders rise and fall at such a high frequency, again, recall, median of 9 years, average of less than 20, and if you exclude, the U.S. Constitution and all those long-lived constitutions from the matrix, you end up with something even smaller than that. Indicates that broad idealist or functionalist causal stories provide only a partial explanation for constitutionalization. This brought a focus on the concrete political conditions that are conducive to constitutionalization and the expansion of constitutional review more generally. A core finding here, in addition to all the existing theories we quickly breezed through, is that strategic behavior by politicians, elites, and courts plays a key role in explaining the tremendous variance in scope, nature, and timing of constitutional reform. Whereas ideational factors may provide a bounded rationality-like platform that constrains the scope and nature of choices, the actual form of constitutional revolutions, and certainly their timing, are explained by concrete political factors. A key factor here is the time horizon or perceived threat to power holders, the arrival of credible political competition or a new constellation of power that makes those who operate in an insecure contractual environment, either politicians or social groups, see the utility of constitutional protection and powerful courts. Embattled elites that have better control over and affinity with the constitutional arena are more likely to resort to the constitutional domain as a power-preserving measure when present or prospective transformations in the political system threaten their own political status, worldviews, and policy preferences. So this is not only or even mainly self-binding against our own imperfections, a la Ulysses and the Sirens, but rather, in addition to that perhaps, self-interested binding of other credibly threatening actors who advance rival worldviews and policy preferences. Having opposed judicial review for most of the 20th century, white elites in South Africa miraculously discovered the virtues of judicial review when it became clear that the days of apartheid were numbered. Pierre Elliott Trudeau's drive to adopt the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms in 82 came on the heels of his electoral defeat in 79, the electoral rise of the separatist Parti Québécois in Quebec in 76, and above all, the credible threat of Quebec secession as signaled by the 1980 secession referendum. In Mexico, the ruling PRI couldn't care less about judicial review for over 70 years, but discovered its charms in the mid-90s when credible political opposition emerged. Israel's labor movement and its predominantly secular Ashkenazi constituencies were for decades agnostic towards judicial review, but embraced constitutional supremacy once their cultural and electoral dominance began to erode. Their historical grip over Israel's governing bodies faded, and new elites and their policy preferences gained influence. The constitutional revolution of the mid-90s then followed. And there are more defensive moves here along the same lines. Having been in opposition for 44 years and fearful of the return of the socialist establishment, the first thing the right-wing coalition in Sweden did in 76, when it finally ousted the Social Democrats, was to recognize the court's authority to exercise judicial review. Conversely, little or no judicial empowerment has taken place in countries such as Japan or Singapore, where a single political force has controlled the political system for most of the last half century, and we'll hear more about this tomorrow, I'm guessing. Scholars have drawn on this power preservation or insurance logic to explain the variance in judicial power between different periods in the late 19th century U.S., between two Argentine provinces, between post-authoritarian Asian countries, between several polities in Eastern Europe, and between democracies in Southern Europe, as I'm sure we'll hear tomorrow about Portugal. In all of these different settings, ideational factors do provide an important yet fuzzy ambience within which key political actors operate. However, no explanation of why the Canadian Charter was adopted in 1982, why Mexico adopted judicial review or expanded judicial review in the mid-90s, or why Israel embarked upon its constitutional revolution precisely when it did, any such explanation must be more concrete than broad ideational processes. Think of a simple logic of insurance. Those who are absolutely confident do not buy it. Residents of California buy insurance against earthquake damage. Residents of the Netherlands or the Maldives buy insurance against flooding. By contrast, life insurance is seldom purchased by young, healthy, vibrant adults. People at an advanced age, unhealthy, otherwise at risk, real or perceived, are much more likely to resort to life insurance. Likewise, if having bought insurance against flooding, one happens to move from the Netherlands to, say, the Gobi Desert, she would want to stop paying for her flooding insurance pronto, you would assume. Accordingly, those whose time horizons have grown longer while in power, make every effort to get rid of limiting constitutional provisions to better suit their interests. So think Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, or Alvaro Uribe in Colombia, or President Museveni in Uganda, and the examples go on and on. They don't need insurance anymore. The assertion that the degree of perceived political threat or uncertainty is an important predictor of whether or not constitutional court and constitutions in general will be established has been supported in a variety of studies ranging from formal modeling to large N statistical analysis. Furthermore, its basic premise that people tend to be risk averse under conditions of systemic uncertainty has been advanced by a wide area of thinkers in other scholarly domains, from John Rawls' principles of justice agreed upon behind the veil of ignorance to Tversky and Kahneman's seminal work on the psychology of choice under conditions of uncertainty. Politicians' drive towards drawing on sympathetic courts when it is politically expedient to do so is perhaps best illustrated in countries where tensions between old elites and new elites are fierce. The historically hegemonic but electorally challenged coalition of monarchists, army generals, and state bureaucracy in Thailand turned to the previously passive judiciary in 2006 and again in 2008 to depose the anti-establishment Thairaktai party, to topple the next prime minister for nothing more than violating the Thai constitution by accepting payment of $200 for appearing on two cooking shows while in office, and to disband much of the People's Power Party, which had won the 2007 parliamentary election. So all of this was done by courts. Clearly, as we see today, these measures were not sufficient to contain the pressure. But at that time, at least they worked for a couple of years. Or take the Kemalist elite in Turkey. It discerned the benefits of a strong constitutional court mainly when its historical grip on Turkish politics became seriously challenged by Islamist parties. The constitutional court dissolved two of those, as we all know, and came one vote short of dissolving the ruling AKP less than 2 years ago. Even in the non-secular world, where religion is a pillar of collective identity and is constitutionally enshrined, moderates and secularists tend to constitutional law and courts to disarm religion of its radical edge. In 1980, Egyptian president at the time, Anwar Sadat, enshrined principles of the Sharia as the main source of legislation in that country, and at the same time established the Supreme Constitutional Court, now a bulwark of relative liberalism and moderation amid the increasing popularity of the Muslim Brotherhood. In Iran, that's right, judicial review in Iran. In Iran, I'm serious, in Iran, Ayatollah Khomeini introduced the Expediency Council in 1989, 10 years after the revolution, to block popular pressures from the generally more progressive parliament, the Majlis, and the distinctly more conservative Guardian Council. We can talk about it later. I'm happy to address this. It's a fascinating example. In 2009, a new 10-member Supreme Court was established in Saudi Arabia. That's right, Supreme Court in Saudi Arabia, staffed mostly with royal appointees, not merely with religious clerics, thereby allowing the kingdom to extend a more pragmatic, flexible application of Sharia to various aspects of public life. In short, even in the least likely settings, constitutional courts and tribunals have been established or reformed so as to hedge or mitigate the tension between political interests, modern-day needs, and principles of theocratic governance, and perhaps more importantly, tame radical religion. Take a related phenomenon, the judicialization of existential political issues, the transfer to the courts of matters of outright and utmost political significance. We are not talking ordinary, today, rights issues. Matters of outright and utmost political significance that often define and divide whole polities. Any way one looks at it, questions such as the secular nature of Turkey's political system, or Israel's fundamental definition as both a Jewish and a democratic state, are first and foremost political questions, not judicial ones. In my home country, Canada, the constitutional reference procedure allowed the government to transfer the entire Quebec question, arguably the most significant political issue Canada has been dealing with over the last four decades, to the Canadian Supreme Court. The result, the Quebec secession reference of 1998, the first time a constitutional court had ever tested in advance the explicit terms of its own polity's dissolution. The experience of the existence of an active non-deferential constitutional court is a necessary but not a sufficient condition for the judicialization of existential political questions. At the very least, the transfer to the sympathetic courts of contested political hot potatoes offers a convenient retreat for key political stakeholders who have been unwilling or unable to settle these contentions or contentious public disputes in the political sphere. This should come as little surprise to those of us who view courts as first and foremost political institutions. Like any other political institution, they do not operate in an institutional or ideological vacuum. Their establishment does not develop and cannot be understood separately from the concrete social, political, and economic struggles that shape a given political system. Deference to the judiciary and the consequent judicialization of megapolitics or pure politics, indeed, the profound expansion of constitutionalism and judicial power more generally, are an integral part and an important manifestation of those struggles, and cannot be understood in isolation from them. The court-centric orthodoxy, common among legal scholars, at least where I'm coming from, is misguided. The portrayal of constitutional courts and judges as the major culprits in the all-encompassing judicialization of politics worldwide is too simple a tale. Strategically motivated political stakeholders are at least as accountable for the judicialization of megapolitics as courts and judges. And if you ask me personally, I think Jeremy Waldron and Mark Tushnet, for example, are wonderful scholars, but they are off the mark in blaming courts for all of this. It's politics, it's not courts. It's not imperialist judges. It's deferential politicians who try to avoid costs for making tough decisions. But that's for another day. The evidence from throughout the world of new constitutionalism further suggests that once established, constitutional courts and judges themselves may speak the language of legal doctrine, but their actual decision-making patterns may also reflect attitudinal tilts as well as strategic considerations vis-a-vis their political surroundings. Maintaining the court's institutional legitimacy or its acceptance by pertinent epistemic communities is important to judges. This is certainly so in semi-democratic or authoritarian settings where judicial independence is notably less entrenched than in the West, shaky at best. Numerous studies suggest that that constitutional courts and judges may engage in strategic decision-making, either because of the variety of costs that judges as individuals or courts as institutions may incur, or as a result of adverse reactions to their unwelcome decisions, or because of the various benefits that they may acquire through the rendering of strategically tailored decisions. Examples are ample. In the early 90s, the Supreme Court of Argentina found the amnesty for the military junta constitutional. 10, 12 years later, following a complete reshuffle of the bench by President Kirchner and one of his predecessors, the court found the amnesty and full stop laws unconstitutional and ordered new trials for several judges. We have straightforward, clear evidence suggesting that the same judges, the very same judges, voted 180 degrees differently when the political atmosphere allowed them to do so as compared to their original vote. So we certainly see some adjustment to the political environment. The first Russian constitutional court was too unfriendly for Yeltsin's taste, as some of you may recall. Well, it was dismissed. Evidence by Lee Epstein and others suggests that the docket of the second Russian constitutional court contained far less polemical issues that could, for lack of better words, piss off the government. In 2000, our friend Musharraf, which I gather lives in London, in Pakistan. Musharraf is in power. The Supreme Court, the coup d'etat took place when? 99, right? So in 2000, the Supreme Court of Pakistan found the Musharraf-led coup d'etat constitutional based on the state of emergency doctrine. In 2009, 9 years later, the ousted Musharraf is now in London. The Supreme Court found the 2007 ousting of Chief Justice Chaudhry unconstitutional. So when Musharraf is in power, ousting an elected political leader by Musharraf is fine. When Musharraf is not in power, ousting of a CJ by Musharraf is unconstitutional and a severe violation of judicial independence. And who presides over the court that decides that? CJ Chaudhry himself. But of course, there are numerous other more modest examples for this. We could, talk about the European Court of Human Rights decision in the Leyla Shahin case, the Turkish veil, the strategic application of the margin of appreciation interpretive approach, and so on. So there are numerous examples, and we don't have the time to go into this. And the strategic interplay doesn't end here. As the recent history of comparative constitutional politics tells us, recurrent manifestations of unsolicited judicial intervention in the political sphere in general have triggered significant political backlashes aimed at clipping the wings of overactive courts. These include deliberately protracted implementation, legislative overrides of controversial rulings, political tinkering with judicial appointments and tenure processes, court-packing attempts by political power holders, disciplinary sanctions, impeachment, or removal of judges deemed by powerful political stakeholders as objectionable or overactive, the introduction of jurisdictional constraints, or limiting the jurisdictional boundaries and curtailment of judicial review powers. In some instances, we spoke about Russia, there have been at least 15 such incidents over the last 15 years. In other places, three times in Ecuador alone from 2004 to 2007, such a backlash has ended in constitutional crisis, leading to the reconstruction or dissolution of constitutional courts altogether. More often than not, overactive courts and judges do learn the lesson. In summary, this part, a realist data-based approach to comparative constitutionalism poses some challenges to the often too idealist accounts of constitutional law and courts in stable democracies. While this approach to the study of constitutional law and institutions may not provide an explanation of all or even most instances of constitutionalization, it marks an important departure from both normative constitutional theory accounts and from political science's early emphasis on functionalist needs and ideational aspirations as the core motivating factors behind the adoption of constitutions. Core socio-political aspects of constitutional law play themselves in many other ways. Let's explore some of those. Constitutionalization has brought about tremendous advances, real and symbolic, in affirming marginalized identities, increasing public awareness to the legal protection of basic rights and liberties, and so on. But here, too, details are important. Comparative examination of constitutional rights jurisprudence, for example, large N studies, God forbid, shows that negative liberties claims, first order, first generation rights and liberties, account for approximately 85% of rights claims worldwide and support success rate of approximately 50-60%. Of these, well, I should qualify, not worldwide, but of sample countries. Of these, about two-thirds are criminal due process claims. Positive rights and group rights, by contrast, account for less than 15% of all rights claims. It varies from one country to the other, obviously, with success rate lower than 25%. So the overall number of successful negative liberties claims is about 12 to 15 times higher than that of positive or group rights claims. The ratio is obviously even higher in some former Eastern Bloc countries. In that respect, there seems to be links yet to be fully fleshed out between the shrinkage of the Keynesian welfare state, the small state economic and social thought that was prevalent for decades prior to the economic meltdown of 2008, and the conceptualization of rights as shielding the private sphere against the long arm of the encroaching state. In fact, one would be hard-pressed to name even a single recent example in the industrial world where the rise of judicial review and individual rights discourse has been associated with an expansion, not a decline, of corporatism, organized labor, or the welfare state. Or consider the formal constitutional recognition of social and economic rights. I know that many of you have thought about it and written about it. The Constitution of Brazil includes detailed, unqualified subsistence rights provisions in its constitution. The Constitution of South Africa, as many of you know, has qualified provisions, so progressive realization subject to available resources and so on, of positive rights. In yet other countries, India would be a good example, such rights have been protected under more generic provisions such as those of human dignity and security of the person. In Mexico, socioeconomic rights are simply not in the Constitution. Despite these constitutional differences, and we have a wide area here, measurements of income inequality and standardized development factors and income distribution, you know, Gini index and so on, are roughly similar in these countries, Brazil, South Africa, India, and Mexico, despite the wide variance on the constitutional protection axis. Section 7 of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms and Section 21 of the Constitution of India are almost verbatim identical, almost word by word. Despite the similar wording of these provisions, in their interpretation, two very different paths have been taken with respect to constitutional protection of subsistence rights. Such rights are appreciated in the Canadian public discourse and have been certainly Canada is the more progressive jurisdiction in North America, not that there is much of a competition, but so despite the fact that these rights are appreciated in Canadian public discourse, they have been consistently pushed beyond the purview of Section 7 by the Supreme Court of Canada. India, by contrast, features vast socioeconomic gaps, yet its Supreme Court has consistently declared claims for subsistence social rights justiciable and enforceable through constitutional litigation that draws on Section 21. So clearly, there's more going on here than the constitutional text per se. Nor does the list of curious cases end with these examples. Sweden, Finland, Denmark, three of the most developed, prosperous nations on earth, have long adhered to a generous notion of welfare regime and relatively egalitarian conception of distributive justice. At the same time, however, they have demonstrated themselves to be less than enthusiastic, to put it mildly, towards notions of constitutional rights, judicial review, and so on. Until a recent constitutional amendment in 2000, for example, judicial review of legislation was explicitly forbidden in Finland. In Denmark, judicial review has almost never been practiced. The Danish courts have set aside legislation only once in the past 160 years. Once in the past 160 years. And the Danish constitution is silent on the issue. In contrast, government policy, in turn shaped by political factors, seem to matter a great deal here. Since he became president of Brazil in 2003, Lula, January 2003, I believe, the number of poor people in Brazil dropped from roughly 60 million to roughly 40 million, while the overall population increased from 175 million to about 200 million. The Gini index reading fell from 0.581 to 0.544. The lower it is, the more egalitarian the society is. Illiteracy rate dropped from 14% to less than 10%, and the infant mortality rate per 1,000 live birth fell from 36 to 22. The social and economic rights provisions in the Constitution of Brazil have not changed a bit, not a single word, since 1988. The impressive improvements in alleviating poverty in Brazil have been achieved mainly by targeted government policies, not by constitutional reforms or by more progressive constitutional jurisprudence as compared to jurisprudence in the pre-Lula years. Now, this, of course, does not mean that constitutions or active judicial review do not matter. Of course they matter. Only that their net significance, pure net yield, is sometimes exaggerated by legalistic views, while the significance of constitutions' social and political context is often downplayed by such doctrinal takes. Before concluding, I want to go back to the non-secularist world. In most religion-laden settings, be it Malaysia with respect to Sharia courts, Israel with respect to rabbinical courts, or India with respect to personal status laws, we see a constant attempt by constitutional courts to subject religious tribunals and interpretation to general principles of administrative and constitutional law, much like the logic that guided the newly established UK Supreme Court. I certainly don't need to tell you about that. Reasoning in the North London Jewish school admission criteria and so on. When was that? Late 2009 sometime? Yes. The idea of subjecting religious entities to general principles of administrative and constitutional law. In all of these settings, constitutional courts are more appealing to the urban intelligentsia, secular or relatively moderate, and cosmopolitan. In just a little anecdote, so about a month before the decision was rendered by the UK Supreme Court, I got a phone call from one of the court's clerks. I'm working in my office in Toronto. I get a phone call from one of the court's clerks. I won't mention his name. Asking me for a decision that had been released by the Supreme Court of Israel on more or less the same situation a few months before on admission criteria by a religious school and to how the Israeli Supreme Court subjected those admission criteria to general principles of Israeli equality, constitutional law, and so on. So this is borrowing international migration of constitutional ideas live. That is how it that's how it works. So I, of course, provided this. I have no idea if it appeared in the final decision, but the judges knew about that decision of the Israeli Supreme Court, of all courts. Yes. And we see, again, the same trend. Fascinating things are going on that may not be understood without the social and political context in Malaysia. I mean, it's one of the craziest, most fascinating settings to study the tensions between secularism and religion. And the Constitution of Malaysia, Malaysia designates ethnic Malay, as it were, as preferred members of the polity. And on the one hand, it enshrines freedom of religion. On the other hand, Islam is the religion of the state. And what you get is tremendous mess that may not be understood. Who has the right to use the word Allah? Only Muslims or everyone? You can't believe how different all of this is from what we are used to here. Never mind personal status laws in India and all of that. So fascinating stuff. And throughout all these, the non-secularist world, constitutional courts make every effort to subject autonomous interpretation by religious bodies to general principles of constitutional law. How North American or European constitutional law are coping with the resurgence of religiosity is well known to many of us. Perhaps less well known is the fact that from the early 70s to 2000 alone, at least 24 predominantly Muslim countries declared Sharia, Islamic law, as a or the source of legislation. Although virtually none of these polities' constitutions was adopted in an authentic bottom-up, we the people fashion. In fact, quite the opposite is true in most cases. Islamization does reflect a set of values that a large portion of the population in these countries seems to support. It is thus hard not to assign at least some genuine ideational, principled, or aspirational motives to these constitutional regimes. But in practice, these countries' actual adherence to and implementation of these principles is often selective, instrumentalist, and self-serving. Every effort is made by moderate, pragmatic regimes, even those who claim to be zealous guardians of tradition, to circumvent certain aspects of religion that are deemed non-beneficial, such as the prohibition on charging interest, just to pick one example, while preserving aspects of religion that are mainly symbolic or that are too costly to transform. A comparison between the light form over substance approach to many religious, economic, and redistributive directives, as opposed to the notably more solemn approach to family and personal status aspects of religion law, provide a simple yet effective illustration of the non-ideational, earthly tone of constitutional theocracy, if you will. We could even argue, as I do in a new book, that all things considered, the constitutional establishment of religion is not only a regime legitimacy-enhancing move, but a rational, prudent strategy that allows opponents of theocratic governance in religion-laden polities to talk the religious talk without walking most of what they regard as theocracy's unappealing, costly walk. Constitutional law and courts, as symbols of state sovereignty and authority, owe their existence to the body politic, not to a divine authority. They share an inherent antipathy towards rival interpretive hierarchies. Many of the jurisdictional enforcement, co-optation, and access to power advantages that gave religious legal regimes an edge in the pre-modern era, medieval Europe, are now aiding the modern state and its laws in its effort to contain religion. The formal constitutional establishment of religion and the granting of limited jurisdiction to its tribunals may be portrayed as a surrender to religion, but in reality, it may paradoxically help limit the potentially radical impact of religion by bringing it under state control. Although establishment of religion does not come without some compromise on universal outlooks, the jurisdiction of constitutional courts in such religion-infused settings, even if formally religious in some sense, will inevitably reflect a less militant view of religious identity. Even in presumably aspirational constitutional settings, politics, be it small or large, matters a great deal. I wanted to speak a little bit about the interpretive clashes in the U.S. concerning reference to foreign rulings, the whole practice of the rift on the Supreme Court and the American legal academia, and to show how it too is basically political or less ideological than it seems. But we'll leave that for another day because I want to leave some time for conversation. So we can talk about the political aspects of judicial appointment processes in comparative perspective, the upcoming hearing of Elena Kagan, the former dean of Harvard Law School, and so on. We can talk about it later. What are we to learn from all of these realist ideas and examples? There is only that much terrain that I can cover in 45 minutes or so, so I will soon shut up. Surely, details and context matter a great deal, and often vary considerably from one political setting to another. What is more, akin to any other major social legal phenomenon, no simple or single explanation can account for the wide range of manifestations of constitutionalism over the last 60 years. So we can talk about, you know, the reconstruction wave of constitutions following World War II, Germany, Japan, and so on. We can talk about post-colonial constitutions in the late 50s and throughout the 60s, or even going back to the Indian constitution in the late 40s. And we can talk about constitutionalization as a result of a transformation or transition from authoritarian to democratic regimes, as in Latin America, in many Asian African countries, Latin Europe, and so on. Or we can talk about the dual transition constitutionalization, as in the former Eastern Bloc, transition to democracy and to market economy. Or we can talk about constitutionalization as incorporation of transnational international law or transnational law documents, as in, for example, the British Human Rights Act of 98, 2000, and so on. Or we can talk about none of the above, some of the countries that don't fall squarely into any of these categories. Either way, it's a confluence of elements that must exist that is conducive to the spread of constitutions and constitutional review, ranging from historical context, institutional features, judicial behavior, to broad social change. That said, empirically grounded, non-doctrinal, comparative scholarship points to some recurrent political patterns that shed new, realist light on the emergence and functioning of constitutional regimes. Either way, we can say with some confidence that no study of comparative constitutional law is complete without paying close reference to the concrete social, political, cultural, and economic struggles from which constitutional law and courts evolve and within which they operate. In many respects, constitutional law is a form of politics by other means. Its spread is at least as much of a social-political phenomenon as it is a juridical one. I'll stop here. Thank you.